So thanks everyone for coming. This is the third in our series of sort of Meet the Author events here at the campus store. It's really great to have everyone here, and this is kind of just a celebration of books being launched by faculty. Professor Edelman was nice enough to come and join us today. So thank you. We'll have a number of other ones going through February into March and into April. So keep an eye on the website or stop in the store, and please do come in if you get a chance. Thank you, Professor Edelman, for being here. Cornell is just an amazing place to live in because those at the forefront of their fields of work live here and occupy buildings just a few feet away. And they can swing in for a conversation or a book talk, and then we can film it and essentially send it around the globe. Professor Edelman lectures here and does research at the university, working with cognition and language, integrating computational theory and computer modeling with his own research in behavioral studies. What comes out on the other side is a book like this one. And this is something special. It's one thing for a researcher in a profession to publish in journals appropriate to their field, and it's certainly an honorable and substantial end. But something like this book, this kind of far-reaching and thorough analysis, the clever and erudite interweaving that one finds in the happiness of pursuit, goes far beyond what is typical. This is a fine and extraordinary read that pulls together a myriad of sources, from neuroscience to pop culture, studies in antiquity to modernist literature, to create a gorgeous panoply that's very difficult to summarize. Its richness, its depth, and irreducibility is its pleasure. Rich and powerful books such as this one elevate not only our moment-to-moment experiences, but they give us a chance to propel who we are into something greater and more varied than we ever thought possible. But let's move into the details, where the true treasure lies. Please join me in welcoming Cornell professor and author Shimon Edelman.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me. This appears to have been an elaborate attempt to see if I can still blush at my age. Can I? I don't know. I can't see myself in the mirror. So I plan to read a few excerpts, maybe 15 minutes all in all, and then whatever discussion develops, I'll be happy to participate. So I start with the author's note, which is very short, and then the very short first chapter, and then the first section out of chapter 5. So the author's note is... according to one popular conception of science that goes all the way back to Francis Bacon's invention of it in 1620, scientific endeavor is all about getting answers from nature. That said, given that the quality of answers one gets depends conspicuously on the quality of the questions one asks, scientific inquiries lacking in intrepidity, imagination, and insight are likely to yield little more than scientifically validated tedium. In the science of human existence, one half expects things to be easier. As someone who lives its subject matter, am I not in the best position to ask questions that go to the heart of it? And yet it often seems to me that the really important questions hover at right angles to reality, manifesting themselves merely by a faint sense of unease or a premonition that I'm about to miss the point of what is happening. By acting swiftly and decisively, it is sometimes possible to apprehend the fleeting question and to put it away for study. Here I make a public example of four such questions captured while stalking me on a hike through the canyon country of southern Utah. Number one, a juniper tree hanging onto a gravelly mound in a bend of the canyon until the next flash flood. Two, a set of lizard tracks in the drying mud. Three, a dusty drive toward a far trailhead down a narrow wash bordered by steep banks, arriving at length at an impassable sand trap. Four, a butterfly. As you can see, such questions lose little of their cunning, even in captivity, where they pretend they are not questions at all, or that they are of no concern to the busy scientist and should be released into the custody of poets or philosophers. Such guile is best overcome by setting aside the conventional divisions between science and the humanities. This is why in this book, my take on the life of the mind and how to make the most of it, while decidedly scientific, is not entirely conventional. Now, the first chapter, which I promise to be very short, it's titled Home Where the Mind Is. There's an epigraph from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. along, whoever you are, come travel with me. Traveling with me, you'll find what never tires. No justice, no peace. When I was 8 years old, I read a book in which a few lines of a poem were quoted. The book was Monday Starts on Saturday by Arkady and Boris Strugatsky. The poem was by Christopher Logue in a Russian translation. I forgot to tell you that this was happening back in the USSR. The book's real title was Понедельник начинается в субботу. The book, subtitled very aptly, A Fairy Tale for Younger Research Scientists, was about the daily life of applied magicians who work wonders by running experiments and solving equations. Whether or not this book contributed to my own eventual choice of career, I enjoyed it immensely. The poem, in contrast, must have gone right over my head. I have no recollection of it from that reading. As I discovered much later, it was an excerpt from Logue's epitaph. You ask me, what is the greatest happiness on earth? Two things: changing my mind as I change a penny for a shilling, and listening to the sound of a young girl singing down the road after she has asked me the way. In subsequent rereadings of the book, once every few years ever since that first time, I found myself becoming more and more intrigued by the poem. Maybe this is because happiness, with which it deals so deftly, is presented in the book as a challenge to the leading character, who works as the head of the computing center at the National Research Institute for Miracles and Magic. By that time, I was a computer scientist myself, albeit with very little magic and no miracles at all to my credit. The challenge is implicit in a complaint voiced by an elderly graduate student, Magnus, who for decades now has been writing a dissertation for the Department of Linear Happiness, and who offers Logue's poem as an example of the difficulties he faces. Magnus sighed. Some say one thing, others another. Tough, I said with sympathy. Isn't it? How would you make sense of all this? To listen to the sound of a girl singing, not just any singing, but the girl is supposed to be young, down the road from him. And that too only after having asked him the way. Is this any way to behave? As if such things could be algorithmized, huh? For many years, I let those questions be. As a little boy, I was pretty happy not understanding algorithms or girls. As a teenager, I was too busy trying to actually get a live girl to ask me the way. As this was still in the USSR, I was unaware that the pursuit of happiness along with life and liberty is an inalienable human right, or I would have felt more relaxed about it. As a computer scientist, I may have been mildly intrigued by whether or not happiness could be captured by an algorithm, but by then I had my own dissertation to worry about. Then I became a professor of psychology, a natural career move for a certain type of computer scientist. Stick around, you'll see why. And things gradually took an unexpected turn. I now had an excuse to think on company time about anything at all having to do with the human condition, a development that made me feel like a bear that wakes from hibernation to learn that a natural food store specializing in bulk trail mix and artisanal honey has been built over its den. My research interests, which for many years had been confined to just a couple of the mind's faculties, mostly vision, then also language, began to broaden. Having discovered the same principles at work in both, I became curious about the rest. By then, I was teaching a big introductory course on cognition, which I felt had to encompass everything that's known about how the mind works. Teaching, when taken seriously, does wonders to one's capacity for critical thinking. I realized that although the existing psychology textbooks were up to the moment on facts, they were decades behind on understanding. I ended up writing a text of my own, which I subtitled, How the Mind Really Works. For a while, the possibility of understanding things for myself with sufficient clarity to enable me to share my understanding with others made me vaguely happy. Then I perceived that the mandate that I claimed for myself came with the rider. If I truly grasped how the mind works, I should be able to also transcend all the usual vague intuitions about when, why, and how a person feels happy and replace them with sound scientific insight. To my dismay, I realized that I would have no peace until the possibility of happiness being amenable to scientific, perhaps even algorithmic treatment was given, if not a decisive resolution, then at least a fair hearing. This book is my attempt at cajoling my conscience into letting me off that particular hook. The journey is mapped out. To forestall the crushing skepticism that people tend to develop soon after hearing about someone embarking on this kind of project, let me explain why I think it is both timely and feasible. In the past several decades, tremendous progress has been made in understanding the mind-brain. It turns out that the principles that determine how the brain gives rise to the mind are very general, are statable in a pretty concise form, and have everything to do with computation. Given that the brain is the organ with which people experience happiness, understanding the brain offers for the first time a real chance for understanding how and why happiness happens, and perhaps for developing some recipes, algorithms, for pursuing it more effectively. The focus on the pursuit of happiness, endorsed by the Declaration of Independence, fits well within the idea of life as a journey, a bright thread that runs through the literary canon of the collective human culture. With the world at your feet, the turns that you should take along the way depend on what you are at the outset and on what you become as the journey lengthens. Accordingly, the present book is an attempt to understand, in a deeper sense than merely metaphorical, what it means to be human and how humans are shaped by the journey through this world, which the poet John Keats called the veil of soul making. In particular, how it puts within the soul's reach a bliss peculiar to each one's individual existence. The fundamental insight that serves as the starting point for my story is that the mind is inherently and essentially a bundle of ongoing computations, the brain being one of many possible substrates that can support them. I make the case for these claims by constructing in plain sight and out of readily available materials a conceptual toolbox that affords the reader a glimpse of the computations underlying the mind's faculties, perception, motivation and emotions, action, memory, thinking, social cognition, and language. This conceptual buildup culminates in an explanation that states in plain language the nature of the phenomenal self and of consciousness. Readers who are interested in the details that I omit can follow the leads offered by the many notes at the end of the book. These conceptual tools prove to be useful in making new sense of the notion of the pursuit of happiness. Quite satisfyingly, it emerges that the framers of the Declaration of Independence presaged the findings of the scientific inquiry into happiness. The dynamics of the self and of happiness is such that the pursuit itself, the journey rather than the destination, is what really matters, hence the title of the book. This insight, such as it is, informs the book's conclusion. The seeker after happiness returns home only to grow restless and eventually succumb to the lure of a new journey. On the basis of the understanding developed throughout the book, the following practical advice is offered as a way of summing up its lessons in 7 words. When fishing for happiness, catch and release. That's the end of the first chapter and a couple more pages from chapter 5, the beginning of chapter 5. So chapter 5 is titled, You Can Talk to Me. In the book, after each title, there are several phrases that capture the sections, the ideas that are going to be expounded in the chapter. So the phrases for this chapter are preeminence above the vole, replicants abroad, the digital revolution, reduce, reuse, recycle, a garden of forking paths, dependencies all the way down, and the last section, it takes a village. And the epigraph, which you could have guessed from the title of the chapter, I should probably try to sing it. On the other hand, maybe I should not. You can talk to me. You can talk to me. You can talk to me. If you're lonely, you can talk to me. And that's, of course, a line from Hey Bulldog by the Beatles. And the second epigraph is from Jorge Luis Borges' The Garden of Forking Paths. The Garden of Forking Paths is an incomplete but not false image of the universe as Tsui Pen conceived it. So, preeminence above all, just the first section, which I will read. The Odyssey, as one of its best translators, Robert Fitzgerald, noted in the postscript, is about a man who cared for his wife and wanted to rejoin her. For 3,000 years now, this story captivates listeners and readers, not just because it brings the hero through spectacular hardships to a happy end, but also perhaps because it presents a puzzle. On several occasions during his 10-year journey home, Ulysses could have renounced adventure and avoided further adversity by settling down with one of the many willing women he met. Some of them like Nausicaa, mere king's daughters, others like Circe and Calypso, immortal. Why did he persist? Young Nausicaa, admiring Ulysses as he passes on his way to the feast in his honor in the hall of her father, the king, simply bids him remember her when he's safe at home again. The goddess Calypso on her island, though, demands an explanation when it is her turn. Son of Laertes, versatile Odysseus, after these years with me, you still desire your old home. Even so, I wish you well. If you could see it all before you go, all the adversity you face at sea, you would stay here and guard this house and be immortal, though you wanted her forever, that bride for whom you pine each day. Can I be less desirable than she is, less interesting, less beautiful? Can mortals compare with goddesses in grace and form? To this, the strategist Odysseus answered, "My lady goddess, there is no cause for anger. My quiet Penelope, how well I know, would seem a shade before your majesty, death and old age being unknown to you, while she must die. Yet it is true each day I long for home, long for the sight of home." As this conversation winds down, Calypso, who has been ordered by Zeus to let go of Ulysses and help him sail home, promises to get to it first thing in the morning. That she does, but not before they do one more time what they have been doing every night for years, ever since Ulysses was washed ashore on Calypso's island. They go to bed. Although the idea of an undying beauty being let down and left flat by a mortal is bound to resonate with any human audience, our enjoyment of the story would be incomplete if the mortal's motives were entirely opaque to us. That they are not. Those of us, especially who know what it means to have a home and a soulmate, have pretty good intuitions as to why Ulysses spurned the offer of immortality in favor of returning to Ithaca in his Penelope. The mind of Ulysses cannot be understood solely in terms of abstract principles, no matter how large these loom in Calypso's calculus of desire. A side effect of the Greeks creating their gods to personify basic drives, the just Zeus, the angry Poseidon, the warlike Ares, the smutty Aphrodite, is that the entire pantheon sitting in caucus may find it hard to fathom a mortal soul, especially if Athena is on vacation. By making Ulysses an offer he can refuse, the nymph Calypso thus acts very much in character. Calypso's bid would have better chances for success in a Beatrix Potter universe, with all the humans replaced by rabbits, frogs, or perhaps talking fish. In all vertebrates, social behavior traits such as gregariousness and monogamy are shaped by balancing the same few endocrine factors. For instance, the relative abundance of the hormones oxytocin and vasopressin in certain key areas in the brain determines whether a species is monogamous or not. This is why prairie voles that lose a mate never take on another one, whereas montane and meadow voles sleep around like it's the 1960s. One suspects that an account of a prairie vole's odyssey on his way back home from a war instigated by the misbehavior of a bunch of meadow voles would be an epic bore. In humans, the standard issue vertebrate social behavior network is topped with a huge information processing apparatus, which makes life interesting. Equipped with a brain that has computational capacity to spare, versatile Ulysses is neither slavishly monogamous nor willfully or even just willingly promiscuous. Behind his happiness with Penelope, who is often called in the Odyssey periphroi, very thoughtful, there is another power which deals with information. This power is an active informational being which lives in symbiosis with humans, but not with voles or any other species on this planet. To such beings, we rent out real estate in our brains in exchange for assistance in love, war, and general procurement of fun. The product of the symbiosis between these beings and our brains is language. That's the end of section one. That's why I plan to read. We can now chat a bit about this stuff, if you like. Thank you. So, you have a question, Jim?
No,
you don't have one?
I was hoping to find some source code.
Well, you know how they say that every equation reduces the readership by a factor of two? I should invent a saying like that for source code. Yeah.
That was a teaser you gave us earlier. We were supposed to supposed to learn in this book why a certain type of computer scientist would become a psychologist.
Right. Should I expand on this a bit?
That's up to you.
Yeah. Well, I was set on this course by a book. I was turned by a book, which was implicated in the turning of probably thousands of people like me. This was Doug Hofstadter's Gedel Escher Bach in 1979, the Pulitzer Prize. And I got a copy, I think, in 1980. And I'd planned before that. I think I always wanted to go kind of into engineering, but my plans had been get a master's in lasers, optoelectronics, that kind of stuff. But after reading Gedel Escher Bach, my life was never the same. I mean, this is the biggest challenge we have, I think. All kinds of, if there are physicists in the audience, I'll probably offend them a bit, maybe, but we can argue then about this. You know, what counts for a complex problem in physics? You have 10,000 variables, like a long list of numbers to manage. Your problem is defined by many, many numbers. Okay, what's a large-scale problem? You know, you want to design an airplane that is more efficient, say, fuel efficient. You measure, you build a wind tunnel, you measure the pressure and the wind speed over the wing in 10,000 places. So you have a list of 10,000 numbers defines a problem for you. Well, how about this thing in here? The list would, on the conservative estimate, would run into billions. So there you go. So that's the biggest challenge. The nice aspect about this is one can make inroads. One can gain understanding of this, which is just totally amazing, and a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So there is this like prevalent metaphor or the notion that like computers are not really creative machines.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't really like, you know, like when you're like deactivating Facebook, for example, have like these like funny codes like, which are not like letters per se, but like are supposed to have letters in it. So you kind of detect it. But
you mean the capture codes?
Yeah, they fail to detect it, right?
Yeah.
So that seems to imply or suggest that like computers like lack creativity. And if our brains, as you suggest, are basically computational models, or could be modeled as such, and like, I understand your contention is that like no other alternative works, right?
Well, computation is absolutely critical. It's totally indispensable in explaining the mind, because this is a standing challenge I throw to my big class in cognitive psych. You know, come up with some aspect of cognition that you think cannot be described in terms of a computational problem, and I'm still standing. So in this particular example, it's an excellent example, actually. Typefaces, you know, and variations on type. This is a great area for creativity. I actually have a distant relative who established a type foundry. So he studied design, and now he creates typefaces. And this is a great field within which to exercise one's creativity. But interestingly enough, that people who got challenged by this insight, specifically by typeface variety, used it as a benchmark for computer creativity. So Hofstadter, whom I mentioned just now, had several graduate students in Indiana who worked on being creative with regard to typefaces. And so that's some wonderful work coming out of there. I should also say that dealing with new variants of familiar forms, it is an excellent example of creativity, but there are others that transcend that, but even those can be described as instances of computation. The idea being essentially variations on a theme. So there is now a growing number of papers which actually look at how having accrued experience and having figured out what dimensions your experience varies along, you put yourself in a position to extend your experience in new directions. And so the most challenging bit is to transcend the dimensions of your experience entirely, to come up with completely new things. And even that is possible, and I guess, oh yes, that the best example is I think evolution. You know, the sentence with which the origin of species ends, that there's a phrase there, endless forms most beautiful. So in an ecosystem, you have essentially continual transcendence of the existing dimensions. Every time a new species emerges, you cannot describe it in terms of the existing species. But what kind of process is this if not computational? I mean, you have certain computational links which are not straightforward, but they are there between the genotype and the ecosystem. And the interaction gives rise to this newness, okay? Newness, new things that emerge from, I'm coining words as we go. You'll have to excuse me for that. So I don't think that's out of reach. And again, one can find not just empty claims, but actual empirical studies that try to quantify human creativity and explain that in controlled settings in terms of those variations on the theme. So, yeah.
Sort of building around what you just discussed and creativity, do you think that human emotions like would be ever able to be coded in a way? I mean, it's a lot of experiential background there.
Mm-hmm.
A machine would store someone's memories and maybe predict how a person would react in a new situation.
Well, I think emotions are computational shortcuts, basically, in the sense that you code certain predispositions to respond or to feel, which are, feeling is another way of responding towards yourself, in a way that is very efficient, very fast. And so instead of, for instance, there being a neural signal that propagates down the usual pathways in the brain, the neural pathways, you have diffuse factors, you have subsystems that project and release neurotransmitters in a more sweeping fashion than synapse, you know, axon to dendrite propagation of signals. So emotions are not outside this realm, you know, of trying to understand cognition, the mind in computational terms. In fact, there are now some hypotheses to the effect that to be truly intelligent, a system, an artificial system, would have to have something like emotions.
But people are so irrational. Many times we think that, you know, if we try to analyze, mm-hmm. we know it's not the right output. It's sort of unpredictable, randomly, so that sort of guides our decisions. That's sort of hard to assume can be thought of.
People are, you're right, but people are irrational relative to a model of rationality that is severely blinkered. If you have a very, very strict preset notion of what rationality means in a given situation, it might seem that people act irrationally. But by and large, in general, we are just rational enough in the proper evolutionary sense to have survived and prospered. So I think any semblance of irrationality or less than optimal behavior is more a measure of our ignorance as to what the true circumstances of the problem are than of the actual behavior. By the way, I just made the mistake of using the word optimal. Evolution doesn't optimize, evolution satisfies. So even if things are suboptimal, but just good enough for a certain purpose, well, they are good enough. So,
evolution sacrifices?
Satisfies. Yeah, this is a coinage by I think, either Alan Newell or Herbert Simon. Simon was an economist who got a Nobel Prize. Actually, he was a psychologist economist, got a Nobel Prize back in the 70s, and Alan Newell was a computer scientist. They collaborate, it's kind of difficult sometimes to distinguish, to remember who said what, but that's a notion of doing just enough to meet the requirements of the problem without spending too much of the resources that you have, satisficing.
But let me ask a related question to that. In order to understand your
definition of computability. Would your thesis be supported by measurements that certain emotions always occur in a certain part of the brain, for example? So no matter how irrationally we perceive them, there is a physical basis for this type of emotion. And would you regard that as evidence for the computability of an emotion or not?
I frankly, I don't see any connection between the first and the second part of what you said. The first part, by the way, I have to remark on. I don't think it's fair to say that any function in the brain is really localized circumscribed region, because if you drive this argument to its logical conclusion, you end up with two neurons in a dish, you know, or maybe 17,000, doesn't matter, that talk to one another, and what this network has emotions. That's, you know, kind of hard to conceive, at least in the sense that the emotions would have to be the same as those of the entire intact brain, actually, which has to be embodied in the human-like body. You can have different body plans and different brains with different endocrine systems and all of that supporting different emotions. To have a fully human, full-blown human emotion, you have to have a full-blown human brain, fully active, connecting through the body to the rest of the world. If you detract from any part of that, you get something, but it's not the full experience. As to how that would reflect on computability or not, I don't see. Maybe you can clarify maybe the question a bit.
Well, I'm looking for a way to compute something complicated with a finite number of steps. Mm-hmm. And that would be one clue, is if there were some limited physical structure which produced across a spectrum of human beings, say, similar emotion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I've missed your point. Your argument must be a different one about how one would go about computing an emotion.
Again, if you admit that emotion is another category of computational states or processes, should be called processes, fairly, not states, because if you freeze time, nothing interesting happens, right? So if emotions are just a particular category of computational processes, then the question kind of unasks itself. Why then doubt their, understandability by the same means that we try to understand the rest of the brain's functioning? I want to give you maybe a sense of how I would go arguing. So suppose, take this challenge of trying to convince anyone who brings a problem that the problem is computational. First of all, we have to deal with the problem, not with the solution. To understand the problem before the solution is totally, totally crucial. And so once we try to understand any of the problems that an animal with a brain slash mind faces, we end up in the same place, which is facing some kind of computation. I can give one example which I use in class to motivate this introduction to cognitive psychology, the big class that I teach. The example has to do with some light falling. I think it's the same example is also in the book. Some light falling on the surface, and some of it gets reflected into my eye, say, or my camera, you know, some robot's camera. No matter how the light is processed, any entity that tries to disentangle the two quantities, the amount of illumination that falls onto the surface and the amount of light that the surface reflects, those two numbers are confounded. The amount of illumination gets multiplied by a coefficient of reflectance, and what you measure, you cannot measure but the product. So inherently, the perception of how light or dark the surface is, inherently, the problem itself is about taking a product and prying it apart into the factors that went into it. You just cannot go around that, which means this particular aspect of vision is about computation. It just cannot be about anything else. And anything you care to bring up as an example of any aspect of the mind's operation, I will give the same kind of analysis. I hope it makes sense, you know, the capsule version of it, like 2-minute version. Say again.
How would you define happiness from the point of view of comfort?
Uh-huh. So first of all, as I actually take care of noticing, an illustrious colleague who wrote a book from Harvard, who wrote a book on happiness a few years ago, mentioned that to try to define happiness ahead of writing about it is like starting a journey by marching into the nearest tar pit. You know, this is not, defining happiness is kind of not a good approach to it.
Marching into the nearest
tar pit.
Tar pit.
Yeah.
So, how do you feel that is happiness?
You know, every one of us knows, I know when I'm happy, you know when you're happy. But, that, you know, that's, which makes it not really the point. The point becoming, I know when I'm happy, but what am I to be happy or not? You know, what am I? What is the self? I think that's a more productive approach. If you understand what, or at least understand better, what it is that makes up a self, I think you'll be better positioned to understand how that self would be happier. And by the way, this would differ between different people. So there are things which make up the aspects of ourselves which are unique to us, and those are unique experiences, and also there are universals. And so in this book, I try to, first of all, give some account, a computational account of the universals, but also show that the unique parts are essentially a distillation of experience. And that translates this seemingly mysterious aspect, you know, my personality, what is it? People spend decades studying personality and other people spend decades inventing interventions, you know, to make things work better and all that, without yet having a clear notion of what a personality is and how it comes to be and how it computes. Well, we now have tools to make the predicament of those people a bit better. And this is totally accessible to everyone. This is not the basic ideas really do not, you mentioned the code, no code, no equations. You don't really need any knowledge of computer science to get, just to grasp the basic computational nature of our minds.
But come back to something you just mentioned before. It is possible for a young person who feels happy, let's say looking at a picture, to mirror a pattern of the brain that corresponds to that, like MRI, right? Like
you can, if you run, yes, no, absolutely.
Parts of the brain that would sort of show a certain, so
just let me rephrase this. It would not be a part of the brain, it would be the whole brain showing a particular pattern of activation. And to decode that, so no, you can hope to do that if you build up a database across many subjects and you find some universal features of, you know, correlates of happiness. That's totally possible. That's totally feasible. In fact, this is now being done for relatively specific states. For some reason, you can guess what the reasons are. It's popular now. It's in vogue to get Tibetan monks into the magnet, you know, to scan their brains while they meditate. That's absolutely an interesting, useful thing to do. And you get some universal patterns, or less universal, maybe just someone who is meditating as opposed to someone who is not meditating. So up to a point, you can find the correlates. To go beyond that, someone would have to scan you in different states as opposed to many people in different states, right? Because we all differ. But even then, it would be nice, it would be replicable, it would be publishable, you know, get a paper, if it's a new aspect, get a paper in one of the best publications, one of the best publication venues. But this is common to all imaging approaches. You know, we are getting, Cornell's getting a new magnet. So we'll start after many, many years, we'll have an ability to scan subjects on campus here. But without knowing what the subjects' minds are trying to compute, you'll just be staring at pretty pictures. So my answer is yes, you can correlate, you can figure out, oh, that pattern, you know, that particular Christmas light display means that subject is now happy. But why and how? And how can we make it repeat itself and all that? For that, you have to study the processes, and the processes are computational.
Do you think other beings than humans feel happiness?
So, do you have a dog? I don't have a dog. But people who have dogs, I think, are totally convinced that, their pets can be happy. Even cats can be happy. I mean, they're kind of grumpy most of the time, but sometimes they're happy, right?
But is there something like research underlying?
So I'm kidding. So seriously now, I think that that happiness is a goad, you know, a stimulus in the old Latin sense of a stimulus, you know, a sharpened stick with which you poke your oxen. You have a team of oxen to plow your field, so you stimulate them. So evolution's goad, this is happiness. You know, a species that gets rewarded in this manner for all kinds of things that are good for it will be happy on occasions. By the way, not all the time, because if you reward some behavior all the time, the reward loses its value. So by that account, any species that competes in an ecological niche would be happy at times. I guess down to sea slugs in their sea sluggish, kind of primitive sea sluggish way. That would not be human happiness. And dog canine happiness is not human happiness. Does this make sense? Well, from the outside, we can only find correlations.
But images of the brain, right? That's the most physical kind of data you could aim.
I guess you could scan dogs and see, yes, and you know, give them a treat or a bone, or let them bring you your newspaper and see if that makes them happy. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's a bit unusual, I would say. I mean, I lived in Romania. I grew up in Romania, so it's a sort of, there are similarities.
Your mom is good in Chișinău.
What is Romania?
One of the seven languages.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So you lived in Moldavia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which that's great. It's a small word. Yeah. So from my experience. I mean, in the people who lived through those years, pursuing happiness was not a priority, you sort of mentioned it, but it somehow gets extinguished. People don't really aim to happiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of a system that builds on you. And very few people, like, I think you are a lucky person who sort of aim, you know, to pursue their happiness and maybe find their happiness. But most people, I mean,
Mm-hmm. First of all, I totally agree. I'm very lucky. Second, there is a wonderful book by Eric Weiner, who was, I think, a journalist working for the NPR, and then he went around the world trying to quantify happiness, following a research in some countries in the world, like 15 or 16 countries, and Moldova was one near the bottom of the list, actually. So some people would find, I already was asked, how come someone from Moldova writes a book about happiness? Seems kind of a strange juxtaposition to them. But that's, it's true that when you do kind of a survey of long-term, you know, life satisfaction, you find differences between nations, and there's a lot of work out there about that. But if people were not experiencing, in a given country, were not experiencing like momentary well-being every now and then, they would not be able to go on living. So I suspect that even in the darkest places, one finds those patterns of internal reward through, for instance, overcoming of hardships. That's one thing that you'd expect to be rewarded for by evolution, right? If you're good at overcoming hardships. So I think that it's a legitimate question, and there are those piles of data about happiness across populations and nations, happiness with regard to wealth, for instance. But I would count that as something built on top of the human universal foundation, which I try to explain to myself primarily in this book. By the way, wealth, someone asked me recently, that there was a paper, I think Daniel Kahneman was involved recently in research, published a paper which showed that wealth above a certain threshold is not correlated to well-being. It is correlated to the general evaluation of your life, but not to moment-to-moment well-being. So you can be rich and miserable, you can be poor and happy. And I truly hope that this latter part of this observation is not taken to be, you know, kind of a guideline for policymakers. But yes. So all those observations are valid, and then this is the computational foundation of it all.
Well, would you say that you yourself experienced something that I thought was just expressed learning how to be happy
mm-hmm.
from at some particular point in your life? You do mention in here that you originally did not know that it was an inalienable right, but I think that was a little tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah. Well, this book got written from the end, kind of backwards. I will not reveal the final paragraph, but it started, as I admit, actually in the acknowledgments, the very last part. I admit that it started with a paragraph which recounts kind of an insight that I had, and then I had to work back from it, and I did my best trying to understand it. And by the way, this is not my usual mode of operation as a scientist. We don't build psychology on personal insight and intuition these days. But we do sit collectively on top of a huge pile of data and insights. So, you know, as a side remark, don't take this to be a promulgation of intuition-based psychology. And things kind of made sense in that respect for me. The basic one, I guess, I already try to express. It's this evolutionary root of the kind of satiation or saturation that we have with regard to a feeling of well-being. So, you know, you achieve a goal, you publish a book, you get a raise, you score a goal, you do something worthwhile, and you want just to be with it and just to enjoy it. Preferably for as long as you can, but well, you can't enjoy it for too long. I think now I understand better why. The answer to why is pretty simple. I think it's evolution, which is the ultimate answer, of course, to many, many other things. But more importantly, how, what the processes are that make it so. And in that sense, this was a personal odyssey for me, which is kind of funny. You'd think this only comes up metaphorically, but no. And I ended up in Ithaca.
Well, so I guess to come back to the main theme of the book, I suppose that what was missing at some point was the perception of the pursuit, the how
mm-hmm.
of the pursuit.
Uh-huh. I can say a few words about that if you wish.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so in the last chapter, I try to draw a distinction and make a contrast between two modes of making things better. One is, and this is borrowed from my older friend and colleague, Bjorn Merker, with whom I discussed those things. At some point, I realized this can be, the issue, the challenge can be phrased in terms of this tension between two choices. One is self-conquest. You can conquer yourself and kind of beat it into shape and, you know, be happy or else. Or you can conquer the world and just in the hope that by being very rich or whatever, very powerful, you will have all the material means of making yourself happy. And both those options are suboptimal. You can be Alexander the Great and not be very happy. Or you can train yourself not to want to be happy, but then the question becomes, what do you lose? And I think you lose a lot. And so I think there's a middle way, which it may sound suspiciously like the advice, just keep doing what you do. you know, just strive for this, a bit of this and a bit of that. And it's okay to strive because that's what we are wired to do. We are human. But don't try to make the moment linger for too long. And I think once we realize why we cannot make the moment linger too long, we can be better adapted or even resigned in some sense to this cycle, the cyclical activity. And that's fine by me. I don't want to try to transcend my nature. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to break my nature because I want to keep being me.
That's great.
So would you agree with the idea kind of that the value, or one of the values of the computational view of cognition would be to understand what kinds of inputs and kind of the timing of things that would allow people to continually be happy as opposed to trying to hold on to a
system mm-hmm.
and then watch it slip away?
Yeah, no, there is a research, Sonia Lubomirsky, for instance, she's at, I think, UC Irvine. She studied specifically, she gave to subjects, the team gave to subjects, I think undergraduates at UC Irvine. This was like before iPhones, so they distributed buzzers or pagers or whatever. And the subjects would be paged and they would have to enter a value for well-being. And then there were several groups for different intervention regimes. So one group were asked to count their blessings once a day, literally to make a list, and one group once a week or twice a week. Turns out once a day it's too often. And the average, the levels of well-being as measured, as self-reported at set times, random times by the page, set by the pagers, the levels of well-being were on the average lower if you were just pushing this, counting your blessings too strongly. So, and this is one of, so this isn't happiness research as such, which I don't do. I don't, although I'm now trying to think of some possible studies to back up those evolutionary claims, but it's too early to discuss them. So this, the scheduling idea, I think it's a great question because apparently it's a very, very good idea. So we are dynamical beings. Things go up and down in cycles. So happiness, well-being goes up and down cycles. You can intervene and make that a bit better. You know, so just you can remember that advice. Count your blessings once a week, you know, or call home or something like that. Once a week. But interventions at preset times are also good for other things, for instance, learning. And recently there was a paper by Eric Kandel, I forget the second, the other author, who take research with, I mentioned sea slugs earlier, so you know aplysia, the sea snail. There is a particular dynamic, particular timing schedule to the way that its habituation, dishabituation, you know, its adaptation to external stimuli works. And this now is being translated into schedules for learning for exams. So it's several, it's not just one hop, you have to make several conceptual hops. But memory research now is getting to the point where one can think of those dynamics and kind of apply that. So excellent question. I think we should, yeah, maybe last question.
As I'm watching now my daughter grow up, sort of trying to revisit times of the same age, but the pursuit of happiness definitely changes with age. I remember seeing recently an article about smiles. Children smile more than 400 times a day, while for adults the statistic is disastrous.
Yes, but for us, each smile is so much, is worth so much more, isn't it?
We're smiling less, but yeah. But this, how would you see this pursuit of happiness through the ages? Is, I mean, our lives get more and more complicated,
mm-hmm.
entangled in the past, and really sort of.
Do you mean personal development, personal aging, or
yeah? Like the pursuit of happiness through ages. I mean, if you would think of a child,
yeah,
then happiness can be achieved.
Yeah, you know, I have good news. I have good news for you. So. It's all about experience. Well, aging is all about experience if you just leave aside the trivial things like, you know, back pains. And so, and the older you get, the more experience you have. And it turns out that the more experience you have, the better means you have to appreciate the qualities of your life. And so in a sense, she would not believe me, but in a sense, you or I, we are better positioned to appreciate life than she is, which is good news. You know, in this sense, the news that the rich get richer is really good news, I think. Okay, thank you all for talking to me.